mean, that's a special kind of stupid.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly, provocative talk radio.
What I say is what I say. And honestly, if you don't like it, I'm sorry.
Lars.
Oh, boys, I'm back.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Now, here's your host.
Wait a minute, I'm talking now, if you don't mind, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. Less than a month before President-elect Donald Trump takes office, colleges are starting to cut their DEI programs and close down their so-called cultural centers nationwide. And I think that's a good thing. So, I want to ask our friend Professor Nicholas Giordano, who's a professor of political science at Suffolk Community College, host of the PAS Report podcast, and a fellow at Campus Reform's Higher Education Fellowship. Professor Giordano, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars. Always a pleasure to join you, and we could at least be optimistic about the higher education system heading into 2025.
Yeah, Trump hasn't even arrived, isn't going to for a little over a month, about a month and 10 days, and yet the colleges are starting to shut some of these programs down. Have they realized that the writing is on the wall, or is there another reason they're doing that?
There are several reasons. The writing's on the wall, but they also realize that DEI is a losing proposition. It doesn't make any sense. It's a toxic ideology, and at the Leadership Institute's Campus Forum, we just put up an article that people can check out at campusreform.org that talks about how a California accrediting agency, the Western Association of Schools, is seeking to remove all DEI-related standards. They want to shift the focus to institutional excellence and success for all students, where the focus should have been the entire time. I mean, that was the whole basis for college. And this will actually force institutions to demonstrate progress in supporting students and preparing them for once they leave the colleges. So this is good news, but it's not just California. We're seeing this across the country. For instance, University of North Carolina has closed down 17 DEI offices and eliminated 60 DEI positions. That translates into millions of dollars that could go to cut tuition costs, to improve student learning, to catch students up from the lockdowns where students were out of school for 2 years. We're seeing movements in 30 states now that have either introduced legislation to take away the DEI standards, or colleges are doing it themselves. So this is certainly good news for the American people.
I would agree with you, but Professor, one of the things that's confused me is why any intellectual, why any professor at a college would have said, yeah, I don't think it's such a good idea to catch kids up. I mean, I had to take bonehead math when I went to I only went to college for about a year and a half, but I had to take bonehead math because my math scores were too low. Everything else was okay, but my math scores are bad. So I took math 99. And you were never that proud of telling fellow students, yeah, I'm in the math 99 class, because they knew that was bonehead math. But if it is, so what? And if you catch up by taking the bonehead courses, great. And if you don't, maybe college is not for you. How in the world did the colleges say, no, we need to go out and tell all these kids that the reason you didn't do well in algebra is because of your skin color, your gender, or how you like to dress, or what name you call yourself? Who thought that was a good idea?
Well, we have to understand that a lot of people within academia are not academics. They're actually ideologues. They're far-left ideologues that want to push an agenda. But ultimately, a college is a business, and there is a bottom line to that business. And so what have colleges seen since this big DEI push? Well, they've seen a major drop in enrollment. They've seen that the focus on race and victimhood, identity politics, well, that's why only 36% of the American people have a great deal of confidence or a lot of confidence in the higher education system. That number used to be a lot higher. They're seeing that 50% of employers have dropped four-year degree requirements for a lot of their positions, because 91% of them say that college graduates aren't prepared for the workforce, that the colleges are doing a terrible job. So as enrollment continues to decline, as confidence in higher education declines, as employers begin to move away from the four-year degree programs, these colleges have a choice. They either reform and make the necessary changes to adapt, or they continue what they're doing, and ultimately they will go out of business.
Well, and how was it that these, even the ideologues, did not foresee that, I think it was Ron DeSantis who called it discrimination, exclusion, and indoctrination, that we were going to get wise to this very quickly when we realized what it was they were pushing on college campuses? Even the ideologues must have realized the hazard of what they were going into, or did they?
No, I don't think they did realize. I think they got overly ambitious. I think with the coronavirus, that gave them a big push. And then the focus on the George Floyd riots that ensued following his death, I think the colleges thought that they would be able to get away with this and that the American people would simply bow down. But as tuition costs go up and the value of a four-year degree goes down, well, nobody wants to end up $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 in the hole and unable to find a job when they graduate. I mean, let's be honest. Most people attend colleges because they want to graduate and start a career. Well, if you can't do that because employers don't like the people that are coming in, the recent college graduates, then that degree is kind of useless. And imagine paying $120,000 to have to work in some retail chain because nobody wants you because of the college you attended.
Well, and one of the things that's always bothered me, Professor, is this overemphasis on credentialism. And I guess you can call it that, where you walk in and you say, well, I came up with some new ideas. Well, do you have a PhD? No. Well, then you can't come up with new ideas. You're not allowed to do it. You have to go out and get this credential, because the credential certifies that. Now, I realize you're a college professor, so some credentials are essential for doing certain jobs. I don't want to go to a doctor that didn't go to medical school. On the other hand, the best builder in the world may not be the guy who's got a degree in material science or something like that.
Well, yes, but the one thing I will say is it's not necessarily about credentialing. I mean, if we go back 40, 50, 60 years ago, the liberal arts programs were designed to educate students and create a productive citizenry.
Yep.
If you could make it through the four-year university system, it showed that you were dedicated, that you were willing to work hard, you were willing to put the effort in. But as standards routinely dropped throughout the decades and then completely collapsed over the last 4 years, well, then it becomes a question of, well, why even go to college?
Yeah.
If we're just going to cycle students through and they graduate and only 36% of them can think critically and they can't read, they can't write, well, then what's the point of college? And I think that's where we've come. I think that's why colleges have started to realize that they need to reverse this trend, because the future isn't that bright. And it gets even worse when we look at the decline in the birth rate and the future populations that are going to be enrolling in school. The numbers are going to be a lot smaller, and there's going to be a lot of competition for those students.
Yeah, and when you run somebody through 4 years of college to get an undergrad degree, and you say, I've proved that I can work through the system and fulfill all the things I'm told to do, that isn't necessarily somebody who's going to be critically thinking. And if you're told there are certain things you're not allowed to think or say, that seems like another way to clamp down on any kind of creativity. That's Nicholas Giordano. He's a professor of political science at Suffolk Community College. He's also a Campus Reforms Higher Education Fellowship. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on a Tuesday.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
It's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your phone calls and emails. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided it will not consider whether three Boston public schools violated the Constitution with race-based admissions. And I thought we'd get an explanation of that from Jim Burling, Vice President at Pacific Legal Foundation. Jim, welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
I don't know if this fits in with the Supreme Court's usual practice, but if they've already decided some, you know, some major cases, as they did for some college students, why would it be so tough for them to say, yep, we accept, and same decision? You can't base admissions on race. That would seem like low-hanging fruit. Instead, they just say, nah, we're not going to consider that one. Why?
Yeah, because, well, you know, that is a fascinating question. And when they said they were not going to take up this case, extending the Harvard and North Carolina cases to high schools, Justice Gorsuch and Thomas and Alito, the three of them, said, no, we probably should have taken this case. Now, Gorsuch said, well, we probably should have taken it, but this case may or may not be moot because Boston replaced the challenge admissions policy with something slightly less objectionable, so maybe the case has to start over again. And I think that the court was just, you know, it kind of shies away from taking controversial cases, and sometimes if they can find any reason at all to avoid one, they will. In this case, the fact that Boston replaced the challenge admissions policy may be such a reason that they said, well, we can avoid that. Although if you look in the dissent by Justice Alito and Thomas in particular, they go and cite what happened in this case and the ethnic slurs that were bandied about by the school board, you know, arguing that whiteies or white people are a bunch of racists and they shouldn't complain about this. It's fairly outrageous. I think the court should have taken this case.
And the other phenomena that I wanted to ask you about is this. Back when Obergefell was decided, that's the gay marriage case, by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
And there were states that had public votes, and the voters said no, no, no. I can't remember how many states said no, but it was a number of them. And then the Supreme Court comes along and says, nope, we're going to lay down the law. Gay marriage is allowed. And you had 50 states, all of which had slightly different marriage laws. And they all fell into line immediately. Well, I guess Tennessee might be one example of where they went the other direction for a time, or one county clerk. But other than that, they all just said, okay, they saluted and said, yes, sir, and moved along. In this case, when the Supreme Court decided you can't have race-based admissions in these colleges, you didn't see other schools falling in line saying, well, if that's the law, then we're going to have to go that direction. They just decided to cut their own course. Can you help me understand why it worked that way?
Yeah, well, you know, they didn't like the decision, whereas a lot of states were unhappy about the gay marriage case. So that was so explicit. You cannot deny the right of people to enter into gay marriages. In this case, the decision from the year ago at the college level, Harvard and University of North Carolina, applied to college admissions. So a lot of the very progressive that like discrimination in school admissions, that is, like to favor one minority over another, they said, well, we have a distinction. That was colleges. This is high schools. Now, you and I can look at each other and say, what? There seems to be a distinction without a difference. But it was
it
all
is.
The distinction that some of these progressive high schools need.
Well, but it is it's all education. And I would even argue that where the colleges are in theory open to all, but you've got to qualify to get in, especially the elite colleges, the public schools are by law in every one of the 50 states open to all. You don't have to qualify to go to a public school. I mean, with the exception of sort of the higher end schools in New York City, where some of the public schools actually have an entrance exam, and you're tested and they accept the best of the best of the best, or whatever you want to say. But why would they say that the public school case, or the lower grades case, K through 12, wouldn't just be covered by the same set of rules?
Well, these are the special schools in the Boston case, and there's a case out of Arlington, Virginia, and New York, where they are special schools. You had to take exams to get in, and the powers that be did not like the results because the exams based on test scores were not favoring certain minority groups. And so they said, well, these exams can be tossed, and we want to have a racial component in these specialized schools that reflects our minority preferences. So, you know, that's the distinction they gave. It's not like getting into your ordinary school. These are special schools, but the whole reason that these schools were created in the first place was to have very special schools so the brightest of the bright can achieve beyond what they could possibly have done in a regular high school. And that is where students are now being locked out. Those, some of the best of the best, have the wrong color of skin, and they're not able to get in.
Okay, now fit the Naval Academy into all this, because Annapolis has a race-conscious admissions policy, and the U.S. Supreme Court's going to let that stand, correct?
Yeah, so in the high school, in the college cases last year of Harvard and North Carolina, the court had a footnote saying, we are not ruling on military academies, because there may be good reasons why there are racial preferences in those academies. And the Supreme Court and the trial judge last week, and with the Naval Academy, said in a 179-page opinion that there are all kinds of good reasons to discriminate on the basis of race for admissions into the Naval Academies, because we need an officer corps that is more reflective of the ethnic makeup of America as a whole. And so we had this judge saying this. It's going to be appealed. A case was filed today by the same group that filed in the Harvard case, in the North Carolina case, and in the Naval Academy case. They filed against the Air Force Academy. So they learned a few things from what happened at the Naval Academy, and so they're going to try to have another run at it with the not only appealing of the Naval Academy, but this brand new case in the Air Force Academy.
Well, see, that's the part that hits me, because, Jim, I guess I go by a general rule that if it takes 179 pages to explain your logic or your reasoning, you probably don't have very good reasoning. You say, well, there must be a good reason out there somewhere why we have to have an officer corps that matches up for both gender and race and every other criteria, you know. And so a federal judge is basically inserting himself in almost as a plaintiff, saying, well, there's probably a good reason. Well, no, I don't think there is a good reason.
So,
what could the good reason be?
I mean, not constitutionally, but what he did was insert 179 pages of testimony and studies that all seem to show that, you know, often that people in the military operate better if the officer corps reflects their racial diversity of the lower ranks. And, you know, that
seems like
sociological nonsense, but that's what the court had to put in order to try to bulletproof the case when it goes up on appeal.
Well, and at least since desegregation of the U.S. military, isn't the military one of the most meritocratic kinds of institutions there is? If you're good, you go from, you know, Lance Corporal to Sergeant, or Sergeant to Lieutenant, or Lieutenant to Captain. And if you're not good, you don't rise. And it doesn't matter who your family is, or how rich you are, or what color your skin is. And they're trying to turn it back to something that you know, is just a twisted version of what it used to be, it seems.
Yeah, they want to have a racial spoil system. I mean, ever since President Eisenhower, when he was a general, he started, and he completed when he was a president, saying there's not going to be discrimination in the military, period.
Good.
And there hasn't been discrimination in the military, period, until we started looking at these admission policies where the military academy started following the general rule that colleges and the progressives across the country have had to have discrimination in order to make sure that the ethnic diversity of the academy was reflective of certain favored demographics. And it's all in violation of the Equal Protection Clause that said every individual should be treated as an individual, not as a member of some kind of racial class.
Well, let's hope the Supreme Court gets back to doing some good work. Jim, thank you very much. That's Jim Burling. He's involved in the legal field. He is the vice president of the Pacific Legal Foundation.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
We Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and a real pleasure to watch the end of the era of Soros, where George Soros, the billionaire, went out and spent lots of money. Well, probably not for him. It was walking around money, I think, to get a lot of radical district attorneys elected around America. And why did he do that? Because I believe that people like George Soros decided we can't get the laws changed the way we'd like to get them changed to forgive people for committing crimes. We'd like the legislatures to do that. We'd like the U.S. Congress to do that. We can't get that changed, but what we can buy is a radical DA or prosecutor in your community who will simply not bring charges or not prosecute the case, which has, well, it's worse because the people say to their representatives, we want laws against these criminal activities, and the laws get passed and put in place. And then George Soros has figured out how to get the person who's the gatekeeper, who decides who gets prosecuted and who does not. Well, it appears that that era may be coming to a very quick end, and I'm glad to see it. Lance LaRusso joins me now, who's an attorney, former law enforcement officer, and the author of several law enforcement-oriented books, most recently Blue News. Lance, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Have I gone too far? Am I over my skis when I say that seeing George Gascon go out as L.A. County District Attorney rejected by the voters, and that on top of Chesa Boudin and Fox in Cook County, that this little experiment they tried failed miserably?
I don't think so. I think what remains to be seen, and this may be, you know, splitting hairs, but the question is, are people just fed up with the crime itself and not really concerned about why it's getting bad? Or are they concerned about the policymakers, like you said, the DAs that are not holding people accountable? To a certain extent, I think the average person on the street really doesn't care where the reform comes from. They just don't want to be targeted for going to the grocery store and robbed.
Well, and I keep wondering, if you think that when there are representatives, both in Congress and the legislatures of the states, who say, let's diminish the penalties for all these horrible crimes, if for the most part, we're talking about person crimes, that is, crimes against people, rape, robbery, murder, assault, things like that. We're not talking about stolen television sets or even stolen cars. That they want to see those things punished because they understand that punishing people for that tends to diminish the amount of that kind of thing that goes on. Who are the people who actually support the point of view that's pushed by people like, people like George Soros and the folks he wanted to get elected? Because I don't think they represent a very large group of people at all.
No, I don't think they do. And I think you're absolutely on the mark with that. I think the interesting thing, what people have been frustrated by, and I think what I saw in the public forums and people, you know, in the public square screaming about crime was they rejected abject lawlessness. They rejected celebrating lawlessness. And, you know, situations where officers, over 305 officers have been shot in the line of duty so far this year. I think people said enough. We'll sort out why. We'll sort out what we can do to fix it. But your program of not holding people accountable and not wanting to put people in jail and keep them there when they have manifested themselves to be dangerous is not working. And, you know, to your point, I think there probably are a very small percentage of people who just philosophically believe that, you know, the prison system is not the way to solve, a crime problem. But I think that that's been roundly rejected by a lot of people. I think you do have a group of elitists who work and live behind locked doors and metal detectors who complain how the rest of everybody should live and say, well, it's not really that bad. I can afford my own security, which is about the most elitist attitude you could get, all in the name of progress and tolerance.
Well, and people like George Soros being the ultimate example of that. I don't know what his personal security arrangements are, nor do I really care. But I would imagine that a man as wealthy as he is probably very, very well protected and not exposed to this at all. And yet somewhere there had to be something in the back of his head saying, yeah, but not everybody lives like I do. And what are all those people doing? Does he just imagine this fantasy world where people are not assaulted, not raped, not robbed, and not killed?
And it's kind of interesting. I don't think he does. I think people who are in that position who can afford their own security, we certainly saw that with some congressional folks who were, and other officials who were wanting to defund the police, but then hiring their own private security, who oddly enough are often retired police. I think that it's probably on a bigger scale. So let's take some of these big box stores that have closed, and you are absolutely right. You're talking about crimes against individuals, but this is an interesting point because the widespread shoplifting, the store takeovers, everybody says, well, that's a property crime. Well, it's not. If you are the 17 or 18 or 20-year-old college student who's sitting in there and 20 people walk in and clear the place out, if you are not in fear of your life, then you're not paying attention. And those are the folks that have said, I'm not going to work here anymore. I'm leaving. And those stores wound up saying, we're going to close. Well, who works at those stores when no one wants to be subjected to that? And where do the poor people in those areas go to shop when there's no pharmacies, there's no big box stores, there's no grocery stores available? So I think that it really was more of a groundswell of, you know, I don't even know what the solution is, but I'm tired of the amount of crime going on. And then I think to add insult to injury was some folks who were running for office turning around and saying, oh, there's no crime problem. There's no increase in crime. As a matter of fact, there's only been a 5% increase in violent crime, which is hardly comforting. It was wrong, but it was also hardly comforting and nothing to brag about.
Well, and what happens to that person who works at the big box store? You're talking about the young man or woman who's got that job, and the store simply goes away. And they say, well, you can get a job at another store doing the same thing you did, but it's 10 miles or 15 miles from here, and good luck. Either you have to relocate your entire existence, or you have to commute a long distance, and if you're, you know, if you're not flush financially, then you may be riding the bus, and then you get exposed to even more crime problems and assault problems. What was the end game for somebody like George Soros to inflict that kind of situation on a society?
It's really puzzling to figure out what the end game has been of any of this. So Gascon was put out of office. Several others were put out of office. And no one really understood, because keep in mind, you talk about not prosecuting people. There's another flip side to this, too. It's while they're not prosecuting criminals and violent criminals, people who have been arrested multiple times for violent crimes, they were targeting law enforcement officers quite vociferously, targeting officers who had to make a decision in a split second about the amount of force that was needed to protect themselves or a third person, and then spending years torturously going through those decisions, second-guessing them, and putting them in jail for murder.
I hesitate to disparage the rest of the people, but if you force all of the aggressive, assertive law enforcement people out and you're left with the people who say, yep, I'll go through the motions, it's a good paycheck, I don't think you get the same kind of policing you would get from the crowd of people you just showed the door to.
Well, you're right. And if you get a judgment against you as a law enforcement officer, remember, these are the same folks that were trying to take qualified immunity away. If you get those judgments, sometimes you become unemployable just because you had the judgment against you. I've represented close to 180 officers involved in shootings, and we've seen several efforts to second guess those officers all the way back to, well, if you just hadn't responded to the call, or if you had been nicer to the suspect, maybe they wouldn't have assaulted you. I mean, some of it is just absolutely crazy getting back to, or maybe there's no excuse for you assaulting a law enforcement officer to start with, so we shouldn't be discussing whether they used too much force, not enough force, or whether they should use force at all, instead of stop violating the law so they wouldn't be having to do anything.
Very well said. That's Lance LaRusso, attorney, former law enforcement officer, and the author of several law enforcement books. Lance, thank you very much, including Blue News, the proceeds of which go to police charities.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Here in just a moment. Like my friend Josh Markey, I'm a car enthusiast as well. I'm not sure as big a car enthusiast as some out there. I mean, I don't collect cars, but I like a great piece of machinery, and automobiles are exactly that. In fact, it's been a little disappointing to me that there's a whole generation of people who apparently don't really care one way or another whether or not they ever learn how to drive. Millennials are infamous for waiting until 25 or 30 or even 35 years of age before they get a driver's license, let alone be able to operate a car. Most of us had enthusiasm for cars years before we got our first driver's license and maintained it afterwards. But I thought we'd talk about that. Usually we talk legal issues with Josh because he's a former DA. You've got to talk first about your enthusiasm for the brand Jaguar, one that I don't share with you, but, you know, that's okay. You can have what you like. And the fact that this company is apparently going to is planning to crash itself into the same kind of mess, woke mess, that Bud Light and Target and a number of other big companies have done.
And they're going to do that, but at price points that are not $2 a can, but more like $100,000 a unit. So it's staggering. So like a lot of young men, I like cars, not because I was mechanical. I just thought they looked really cool. And Jaguars were particularly cool. They were not only cool looking, but they were cool in the movies and in TV shows. And they also were notoriously bad mechanically, at least in the 70s and the 80s, because of, frankly, socialism and the way the company was being mismanaged. So when I turned 40, my midlife crisis was I bought a used Jaguar, was something I've been looking forward to. And it is the things that I love about a Jaguar is it's all real. It's all real steel. The inside of the car is real wool. The leather is real leather. And when you look at the dashboard of a Jaguar, that's real walnut. That's not plastic. So the car, you know, sort of, it speaks to me and to some people. As you point out, Lars, it is not wildly popular, and it's relatively expensive. And it's had to struggle a lot, as other kind of car brands, and as you say, millennials and the X generation. But something else has happened, something that none of us saw coming. And that was all of a sudden, a couple months ago, Jaguar, which, by the way, was bought by Ford Motor Company in 1988, which improved the car immensely. And then sometime in the early '00s, it was purchased by a giant Indian company called Tata Motors.
Yep. Tata Motors.
So Tata Motors rolled out a completely new look. If you go to Portland Descent, that's the Substack on which I sort of guest write, there's the ad is there. The ad is incomprehensible. It's like a very bad version, for those who will remember it, of the 1984 ad that introduced Apple,
throwing the hammer through the screen of the computer and that sort of
1984, like, yep. Orwellian. Yeah, it was a clever ad at the time, except this is various androgynous and unknown gendered people also sort of marching around in sort of appalling colors. There's no car. There's no discussion of cars at all. It's just preparing, you know, you to get ready for presumably the ultimate woke experience.
Well, see, and the thing I don't understand about it, Josh, is that companies want to grow, or they at least want to stay the same size. Usually, if you're not growing, you're probably dying.
But they want to sell products.
Yeah, they want to sell products. And you've already pointed out this is already a company with a challenge there. And they've already seen over the last couple of years the disastrous outcomes of going woke. You know, Dylan Mulvaney and Busch Light Anheuser-Busch is one of those examples. But Target is another example. Disney is a major example. You can go right down the list. What in the world would possess people to say, let's take our company that's already having a tough time making and selling cars, and let's do something that appeals to a tiny, tiny percentage, maybe less than 1% of the people in the Western world?
I think it's a form of arrogance, and I've certainly seen it in the legal, and we see it from what we talk about, this wokeism, that you have people in the high offices of the bar associations, the medical associations. When you really sit down with many of these people, say, do you really believe this nonsense? They'll go, well, not really, but we need to reach out. And, you know, reach out to what? Transgendered lawyers who dress up, you know, 6'8" men that like to dress up in pink tutus. I mean, really, what significant number of these men are going to be A, successful, and B, spend money on traditionally, let's be blunt, a chick magnet car, which is what, you know, the sort of joke was that a Jaguar for 20 or 30 years is if you wanted to, you know, look cool and have, you know, good looking women look at you, you know, have a Jaguar. I mean, that's kind of infantile, but it's so far away from this. You have to sort of wonder. And in the interviews, the guy from an American company, which has pitched this successfully, is saying, no, this is about basically taking a stand. And it really, people are saying, well, what does it have to do with a car? Or even if you don't want to talk about the car, are you saying that the car is going to be more, you know, ecological? And there's no answer. It's basically, it's one thing to buy a beer and say, oh, well, this is the cool, hip trans beer. Because the beer only costs, I don't know, what, $2? And if you don't like it, you don't buy it again. When a car, particularly a Jaguar, has a starting price point of $96,000.
Well, that's the new one, right? The new Draguar.
That's the new one. Right?
They may be calling it the Draguar.
Yeah, absolutely. Or the Jaguar. I mean, you can go on X. I really encourage, you know, Portland Dissent was very generous, and I'm not one of their regular writers, but they encouraged me to do this. And it's the kind of quirky writing that they do. And it's the kind of thing, by the way, that you would never see, not only in the Oregonian, but certainly not even in Willamette Week, because this is the sort of the sin that no one dares say its name. No matter how outrageous this is, you would not see a discussion of this sort of interesting cultural moment anywhere except a place like Portland.
Well, and frankly, I'm kind of optimistic about where we're going, Josh, because I think what's going to happen is this is a self-correcting problem. The company decides to commit a very complicated form of hara-kiri, and they're going to do away with themselves by shrinking from small to almost nothing. I guess that's a self-correcting problem to me. Josh Marquis, former DA and writer about cars and things Draguar. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now,
Lars. Real Red Meat Radio.
I mean, that's a special kind of stupid.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly, provocative talk radio.
What I say is what I say. And honestly, if you don't like it, I'm sorry.
Lars.
Oh, boys! I'm back!
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Now, here's your host.
Wait a minute, I'm talking now, if you don't mind, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I've got the chance to talk to Bob Barr, former member of Congress, former CIA analyst, and president of the NRA. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Lars. It's always great to be with you all and your many, many listeners this evening, before Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you and yours. But having said that, Bob, have you been following what's happened this evening on Capitol Hill as Plan B got voted down and failed to pass?
Well, you know, we've seen this so many times, Lars. You'd think that at some point in their careers, the Republicans would learn a lesson that when push comes to shove, you don't try to compromise with yourselves, and you certainly don't go against President Trump right after he has won a sweeping election. But they just don't seem to learn their lesson, Lars. I saw it a number of times when I was in the House. and a number of times since then, and darn if they aren't doing it again.
Well, because, Bob, the thing that floors me, and I've spent zero time in politics. I mean, I've covered politics, but I've spent zero time. I've never sought elective office. But what I don't understand is how they can be. We talk about the Democrats being tone deaf, but imagine how tone deaf it is. Americans say, we're tired of the spending. We're tired of all this. We're going to elect a president who promises to go in and make the government more efficient, cut things that shouldn't be there. And the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, who should be paying attention, they bring to a vote a bill that included, according to Chip Roy, about $330 billion in new spending. I mean, not just continuing the operations of the government. Now, a bit of it was going to go to hurricane relief, which is a new, you know, need because the Biden administration ran the agency out of money paying for illegal aliens. But they included in a pay raise for themselves. A readjustment of Social Security, but only for government workers, more latitude on health care, improvement of health care benefits, but only for government workers. Did they not understand that that was not going to sit well with most Americans and real conservatives?
No, I don't think they realized that. And it's the disease that we've seen infect members of Congress, many of whom come from conservative districts and do a good job of otherwise representing their constituents back home in the heartland or wherever. They get to Washington and they are taken in by the need to get along, to compromise, to reach an agreement. And they just sort of forget about everything outside of the bubble in which they work up in Washington. It's amazing. I saw it, Lars, over and over again during the years that I was up there, and it just continues. They just are tone deaf and live inside the bubble and think that the most important thing they can do is to show the country that they can compromise.
Yeah, except that in this case, the compromise apparently was to say to the Democrats, oh, you want a bunch of little Christmas tree ornaments hung on this thing? Okay, we'll add that in. And apparently none of them said to themselves, the ones that voted for Plan A with the extra $330 billion said, hey, Americans just said they want the government to stop all this crazy spending. That's what we ran for election on, and we need to stop this. So I'd like your prediction, though. So Plan A has gone down in flames. Plan B has now gone down in flames. Does the government just hit its deadline tomorrow and shut down for a time?
Well, I guess we can only hope that will be the case.
I'd like
Of course, you know, and I suspect that your listeners know also, that a government shutdown is anything but a government shutdown. Back in, I think it was 1995, 96, during Clinton's term, when I was up in Washington, and it was the first time that we had a real so-called government shutdown. And as I would drive into the Capitol every morning, this was in December of 95, January of 96, I think, WTOP, which I think was the largest radio station in D.C. at the time, maybe still is. They would play this ominous music, like a loud funeral dirge, and then they would have this person come on with this deep voice, government shutdown day 14. But the only thing that shuts down are programs and government services that ought to be shut down. You know, Social Security doesn't stop. The military still gets paid. But all these other programs don't. And it was actually kind of a refreshing time to be around because some government programs just stopped getting funded for several days, and at the end of which the world had not imploded or exploded, the sky hadn't fallen, and things went on.
You know, it's funny, Bob, because we made that our X poll today, because I had that same thought. I said, should we shut the government down until January 20th and let the new government decide? And I said, the only thing that irks me is, let's say they shut down for 30 days. That would be a longish shutdown compared to most of them. They tend to be kind of short. But if they shut down, then what happens is when they start back up, they say, well, we can't leave those people without a paycheck. Well, Bob, I don't know, for my money, and it is my money and your money, I'd say, you mean they sat at home and didn't do the job they were supposed to do? Who gets a paycheck for sitting at home and not doing the job? And you say, well, it wasn't their fault. I said, it doesn't matter if it's their fault. You know, if you sit at home and you don't do the service to the American people you were hired to do, what justifies cutting you a paycheck?
Well, there's no justification for it. And I tell you, as interesting as it was to have lived through some of these so-called government shutdowns back in the late 90s and early 2000s, now with a reinvigorated President Trump and Elon Musk in charge of cutting government waste, fraud, and abuse, I tell you, it is going to be an historically exciting time the first several months of this new administration. I can't wait. I think it's going to be something for the ages.
By the way, you had written about, and I wanted to ask you about this while we have time. I'm talking to Bob Barr, the president of the NRA, but you said, if you verbally attack or even criticize public transgenderism, you get roundly condemned. And yet, if you come out and you speak out in favor of killing unborn babies, no condemnation at all. Seems like a double standard.
Well, it is. And it struck me in the context of the latest hero of the left, the fellow that allegedly, apparently, obviously to me, murdered the healthcare CEO, you know, making this guy into a hero. Really illustrates as clearly and graphically as anything that the left doesn't care about life. They are infatuated with lifestyles, but not life. And I just thought it was time to call them out for what they are. They are absolute hypocrites.
Absolutely. Thanks very much. That's Bob Barr, former member of Congress, now the president of the NRA.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Experiencing technical difficulties?
That electrician must be a Democrat.
No technical difficulties here. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. I want to ask you this. Is it possible that with the arrival of Donald Trump at the White House and taking the oath of office on January 20th, that we can get America realigned with the constitutional requirements of this country? We are a federalist republic. We are a place that is not a democracy, no matter how many times the Democrats say it. And we have a representative form of government. And at least in theory, under the Constitution, we have the enumerated powers of the federal government. And that's the roadmap. You stay in your lane. Well, the federal government has not been very good over the last couple of hundred years at staying in its lane. And I want to bring to the program Emmett McGroarty, who's an attorney and a faculty fellow at Belmont Abbey College's Honors College and co-author of a brand new report called Restoring the Republic that was done for the Pioneer Institute. Mr. McGroarty, welcome to the program.
Laura, thank you. And the answer to the question is yes, we can reclaim the Constitution. It's our Constitution. And I think we all see that, thanks in large part to people like you and your audience. People are standing up and they're saying, wait a second, that Constitution is meant for us to direct government, not for government to intimidate us and to treat us in a paternalistic manner, to make us, as Woodrow Wilson wanted, make us into a bunch of rubes. So, yes, the answer is yes.
Well, and in fact, if we told the federal government, this is the lane you're supposed to be in, these are the powers you have, this is all you get, everything else goes to citizens or to the states, but you have only these limited tasks to do. If we get them back in there, that would help solve some of the overspending in Washington, D.C., too, would it not?
It sure would. It would help things across the board. And you know that my co-authors and I that's part of our motive in putting this little booklet together, and that's, I think, the way the progressives have worked over the last 125 years or so is, you know, they have big picture agenda, but they've really implemented it in a whole host of small little maneuvers under the radar screen that people really weren't even aware was happening, and really in many ways for that reason haven't been an issue in the public square. But now I think I think people are realizing they have to make it an issue. So that's what this book does, is it gives a list of issues that have to be presented to our political leaders and say, we want you to tell us what you've done to give us back our Constitution, and we want you to tell us what you're going to do in the future. And here's some ideas. But let's
By the way, can
here.
People get a copy of this blueprint, this 100-page or 100-day blueprint?
Yes, sir. They can go to pioneerinstitute.org and download a copy for free. And a hard copy will be available soon.
Okay. I want to ask you, what are the specific, can we get down to some specific examples? Because so far we've talked in theory. Okay, the federal government needs to get back in its lane, which is something I'm in favor of. And I can think of some specific examples. But what would happen in those 100 days if we were to force the federal government back within the constraints that the Constitution laid out?
Well, we have a whole host of things, some legislative ideas, but then some that can be merely instituted by executive action. One is, for example, an executive order telling the federal agencies, you may not tell a state who within the state has to accept a grant offer. And you may not tell the state the process they have to go through in evaluating and accepting that grant offer. That's what the federal government does. There was a University of Chicago law professor came up with the term consent conditions. But the federal government says, well, look, if you want to engage in this conversation, here's how you have to act. And what that does is it end runs the state decision-making process. And then, the states sign on to these grants and these conditions on a whole host of things.
Well, let me ask you about one specifically, Mr. McGroarty. So you've got, we just found out today, the Biden administration has spent $1 billion in the last 4 years on what they call DEI initiatives, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Does that mean the federal government and these agencies say to states and to school districts and cities and counties, we've got this cash, and we're going to dangle the cash out there. If you want the cash, you have to do things this way. And they get a chance to effectively legislate what's going on in the states, even though they have no legislative authority, and that authority really should be with the state and local officials in each one of the states. That's the kind of thing that you would forbid?
That's the kind of thing, yes. You know, what happens, like, you could go to well-meaning state legislators and say, hey, what why'd we sign on to this host of things? Yeah, that's how we got Common Core, among other things. And a lot of these bad government programs come in this way. Your state legislator would say, whoa, 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 I didn't know this was coming in. I didn't sign off on this. And sure enough, it goes to these grants and grant conditions. They go to the state bureaucracy, and they say to them, you sign on to this. And then it's negotiated between the federal government and the state bureaucracy. The legislature is pretty much cut out of it. And then, you know, when they hear it, they say, oh, yeah, well, we've already committed ourselves to it. We're really depending upon this money. So that's what some of these reforms would do is say to the federal government, wait, in dealing with the states, you have to deal with them. You have to respect their decision-making process. That's not done right now. Federal government doesn't respect the state decision-making process. So we have several reforms in here that would help bring that about.
Well, and in fact, one of the concerns I've got is at both the federal and the state level, you've got bureaucracies that are effectively doing Congress's job and usurping the state's power. So Congress says, we don't want to pass all these rules. Why don't you, the bureaucracy, do it? And the bureaucracy is happy to do it. They're not elected by anybody. They're not recallable by anybody. You can't get rid of them and vote them out of office. So they make all the decisions. Congress gets forgiven of that. And then at the same time that they're doing Congress's job, they say, oh, and by the way, we're going to replace your representatives in your state capitals at the same time. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah. I mean, that's what's going on here. You have these angles coming from they're attacking this from different angles. So you talked about Congress. Yeah, Congress has gotten a habit of passing these big, very ambiguous packages. And a lot of congressmen don't even know the details. I mean, you get a thousand page bill act or put on your desk and you have 3 days to review it, if that. And no one can possibly go through that in 3 days. And that's how a lot of your sort of social spending on things like education and housing and transportation, that's how that all gets pushed through. So we've got to, one of the things we have to do is we have to give Congress more resources so that they don't have to go to the federal agencies. And if they ask a question, they depend upon a response from the federal agencies or from the state agencies. Congress has to have the capability on its hand to know what needs to be done. And what needs not to be done.
Well, I would like to see that happen, too. And Mr. McGroarty will advise people, you can get a copy of this 100-page blueprint to return America to its constitutional roots from the Pioneer Institute based in, where else, the center of big government, and that would be Boston, Massachusetts. Mr. McGroarty, thank you very much, and have a wonderful Christmas. We'll get back to you in just a moment. I'll get you your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
This thing.
Everyone's favorite color is gold.
I can proudly proclaim that the golden age of America is upon us.
Sit back and enjoy. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've never been invited to testify before the U.S. Congress. I suppose if they asked, I might be inclined to do it, although I don't know what they'd want to talk to me about. But I know what they were talking to Zach Smith about, legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, co-author of the new book, Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. Zach, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on this evening, Lars.
Hey, is there any chance that Congress is actually going to pay attention to what you had to say about guns and crime in the United States? I mean, should I put a bet down on it?
Well, I certainly don't think Dick Durbin, he might have listened to what I had to say, but he certainly did not like it, which I consider a win every day of the week. Unfortunately, Dick Durbin and other Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, instead of focusing on what's actually causing needless deaths and harms in our communities, violent crime, they want to blame guns. And so they, at the end of their term, the end of their time in power in the Senate, they're hosted a hearing on gun control where they're pushing for more gun control measures. And my message to Dick Durbin and the other members of the Senate Judiciary Committee was simple. Guns don't commit crimes. Guns don't cause needless deaths. People do. And if you're serious about protecting our communities, you have to get serious about combating violent crime.
Well, even the fact that you pointed out that the title of the hearing, I mean, they don't lack for paperback on Washington, D.C., how bump stocks and other conversion devices are amplifying the gun violence epidemic was the title of the hearing, kind of long and ridiculous because, look, bump stocks are a gimmick. I had one once somebody gave me. I had no interest in using it, but I want people to be able to buy it. It's not a gun. And yet ATF came out, and I know this was during Trump, and they said, we're going to ban bump stocks. And conversion devices, I take it that meat refers to people who sell the Sears or the other things that can be used to make a semi-automatic behave like a machine gun, although it's still not a machine gun. But, Zach, how many machine gun crimes did America have last year?
Very, very few, Lars. And even fewer are the number of crimes used committing bump stocks or these other devices that were the focus of this hearing. Look, we don't lack for gun control type laws in our country. In fact, many states, the federal government certainly has a number of gun laws, gun regulations on the book. I think any lawful gun owner will tell you that they had to go through a process, an onerous process, to own a firearm that they possess. Even more of an onerous process if you do, in fact, want to legally own one of these bump stocks or other conversion devices or an automatic gun. What is happening in our country today is there's simply not an enforcement of the laws we already have on the books. Look, we know that a very small number of people are committing the bulk of violent crimes in our country, and there's a law on the books called 922G, felon in possession, that makes it a federal crime for someone who has been convicted of a felony or certain other offenses to possess a firearm. And yet, for some reason, the Biden DOJ has not prioritized those types of prosecutions. The Trump administration did during its first term in office, and I'm hopeful that the Trump administration will prioritize those very straightforward, very important prosecutions during his new administration.
I'm talking to Zach Smith from Heritage. He's also the author, along with Cully Stimson, of Rogue Prosecutors. That's the part that bothers me, I guess, the most, because we always hear that there's a shortage of resources, even in U.S. attorneys' offices. Well, we don't have enough lawyers to do all these cases. And I think, hold on, you arrest a person, man or woman, usually a guy, and he's got a felony record. That's easy to prove. You've got the documents right there, and he had a gun on him, and you have two or three or four or five witnesses that he had the gun on him. And then maybe I'm looking at the law too simply, but I'm imagining a U.S. attorney's office that sends a notice saying, we've indicted your client for this crime. We have the pictures, the body cameras of him being arrested. We have the gun on him and multiple witnesses, and we have his felony record. Bring your client in, or you, the lawyer, come in, sit down and tell us what he's willing to plead guilty to. Otherwise, we're going to walk into court, and in about 15 minutes, a federal jury is going to find him guilty and send him off to federal prison. That sounds like tinker toy level law. And am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely not, Lars. In fact, it sounds like you could try one of these cases if you need
to. That sounds easy.
Well, it is. And look, when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, one of the cases I prosecuted, someone with a felony record was picked up with a firearm. He had it in a backpack in between his legs in the backseat of a car. He claimed the gun wasn't his. And I said, you know what? I'm willing to take this case to trial. And guess what? A jury agreed with me that the gun in his backpack between his legs in the backseat of a car was in fact his, that he possessed. And so this isn't a resource issue, Lars. This is just a lack of willingness on the part of the Biden DOJ to enforce these laws. They're very simple, very straightforward cases, don't take a lot of resources, and yet they're very, very impactful because they're targeting often the repeat violent offenders who are wreaking havoc in these communities.
Well, and Zach, the other example of the other kind of case that I think ought to be nuts and bolts to do is the straw purchase. So you've got a bunch of people who have felony records, and they find somebody who's within their thrall, and they say, you like taking, you like cocaine or methamphetamine. I've got that. I need you to take this $500 down and buy a gun because you don't have a felony record and you'll clear. And these kind of cases happen all the time. And there was one case I can remember where and it was the U.S. Attorney's Office. They sent out a press release. 34 times this guy had a young lady who happened to be addicted to drugs go down and buy pistols for him. And he did them by order. Basically, his clients, I think generally in Oakland, California, were telling him, I need this kind of gun. He would send this, you know, prostitute and drug addict down to buy the gun. She would bring the gun back. She'd get a little bit of drugs and he'd get the gun. Mark it up. I don't know how much he stepped on it, whether he marked it up double or triple or whatever it is, and put the gun in the hands of criminals. That sounds like exactly the kind of, you stop that guy, the supply line for guns into the hands of people who are gang members and criminals. And I thought, how tough would that be? You get the young lady to roll over on the guy because she's a drug addict. And we say, we got you on video. We've got you at the store. We've got you signing your name. We've got your picture ID. You need to roll over and testify on this guy. You know what the guy got? For 34 straw purchases, he got 28 months. And I thought, hold on, he could have got, I think, 150 years, maybe 170 years in prison. He does 28 months, and he probably figures, cost of doing business, right?
Yeah, but he won't even do the full 28 months, Lars, because by the time you factor in good time credits, other time served credits, he'll likely be out of prison much, much sooner than even that very short sentence. Look, I think, unfortunately, what's happened is that many on the left simply don't want to confront the fact that their policies are absolutely wreaking havoc in cities across America. And until they get serious about recognizing that it fundamentally comes down to a willingness and a need to hold people accountable when they break the law, when they harm others, until our elected leaders are willing to confront that very simple truth, I think, unfortunately, many communities are going to continue to suffer as a result.
Zach, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Zach is author of Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. So tell Alexa to play The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson
the
Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
I mean, that's a special kind of stupid.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly, provocative talk radio.
What I say is what I say. And honestly, if you don't like it, I'm sorry.
Lars.
Oh, boys! I'm back!
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Now, here's your host.
Wait a minute. I'm talking now, if you don't mind, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. What happens when a young lady comes to the United States as a refugee, as a child from Vietnam, becomes an entrepreneur, and then for a time was a fundraiser for both Obama and Biden, and has now turned into a Donald Trump supporter? Allison Nguyen joins me now. Ms. Nguyen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Lars.
One of my big concerns is that China wants to replace the United States as the preeminent country on planet Earth, militarily, economically, diplomatically, and in every other way. And you wonder how to counter that. You've suggested that one way to do that is to get deeper ties with Vietnam.
I do. I think that's a good idea. China is figuring on biggering and biggering. That has been their strategy all along for the last 2,000 years, and more so now with this communist regime. And I really do think that Vietnam offers a backup plan for the United States in terms of China's expansionist colonialism tendencies.
So what is it that we do? Do we have to effectively have our own Belt and Road Initiative and say to countries like Vietnam, we'll come in and help you out with things in exchange for your allegiance? Or does it have to go that far?
You know, I think we could be really creative. I love how President Trump is negotiating on TV with Mr. Song of Japan.
Would you mind? Did you watch that exchange, Allison?
I did. I watched it in real time. On my friend's network, the Real American Voice Network, Charlie Kirk, Jack Pazzo, and Adam Weiss. I thought it was really funny and a princess moment where he pledged $100 billion, but what about $200 billion? And on the spot, like, you know, if you're not used to TV, then you just want to be agreeable and don't lose face because of the Japanese culture. And I think President Trump is very savvy.
As long as a top CEO who can control that kind of cash doesn't take offense that he's given a little bit of pressure on television, he said, "Yeah, we can look at that." He was generally agreeable to the idea of doubling an already very substantial investment into the United States.
Yes, he made so much money with the ARM investments. I mean, this guy has had so many hits, and it's not like he's giving $200 billion for free. He's going to make $1 trillion out of that $200 billion. So we think we're getting a good deal, but he's actually getting a great deal. We're giving him the opportunity to invest in America, and he's going to turn that $200 billion into 2 trillion. And that's what he did with ARM technology, which came out of Intel Corporation, an American company that was mostly funded by a lot of military contracts. So I think this is a great deal for SoftBank.
I'm going to have to ask you about your political fundraising for Obama and Biden in a moment. But I see, I've never objected if somebody says, well, that guy or gal just wants to invest a lot of money and make a lot of money. I say, yeah, go ahead, let him. Because every time you let somebody become a billionaire or a trillionaire, you usually spin off hundreds or thousands of multimillionaires and maybe even billionaires as well. Every tech company does it that way. They don't make money without everybody else making money. And what's not to like about that?
Yes, and creating jobs. When the tide rises, all boats rise with it, right? And yep. Think about the hundreds and thousands of jobs that it's creating for Americans. It's, you know, especially with tech, AI, quantum robotics, it's offering a buffet for all Americans to eat. It creates jobs, whether they're in manufacturing, software, sales, and executive roles.
So what is it that Vietnam needs that they don't have that could make this deal attractive for them? And are they going to be comfortable doing it, Allison, with China right next door?
Well, we kind of have to really understand the, you know, the social, political, geographical area of Vietnam. And so the area of Vietnam, it has a 1,000-mile coastline along the South China Sea, where about 60% of all maritime trade goes through. And in that 1,000 miles, there's really no place for refueling, repairs, humanitarian missions. And the U.S. doesn't have a presence there. And China is like now very quickly building these artificial islands called the Spratly Islands. They're bullying Vietnam, Philippines, Thailand, everyone in that area because it's a land grab. There is a deep sea port that was built by the U.S. U.S. Navy during the Vietnam War. And I'm not advocating that the U.S. government puts money into retrofitting this, but it could be a private enterprise. It could be a public-private enterprise. But I think it's really important that we repair and retrofit this to help strengthen regional stability and the freedom of navigation. So this important maritime trade route is not controlled by the Chinese.
Because that's, am I overstating it if I say it really looks like that's what China's trying to do, to extend its reach, the artificial islands that they're building, and then simply to say this is our territorial waters and we say who uses them and who does not. Does Vietnam have to worry about that?
Well, imagine an artificial Great Barrier Reef. We know that it surrounds part of the Great Barrier Reef around Australia. China essentially is building a Great Barrier Reef, artificial islands around Vietnam to basically control the South China Sea. And that will continue to build over years. So we need to have some type of intervention. I'm not necessarily calling for the U.S. government to put taxpayers' money there, but perhaps partner, work with private enterprise. I'm a very strong believer of American first policy and what President Trump is doing and his strong negotiation skills. I think he's brilliant and used his brilliant negotiation techniques to really get a benefit out of this without incurring costs for American taxpayers. Look at what he did with SoftBank, right? Look at the great deal he got. And we need to use some of his savvy, his business savvy. We don't have to be cutthroat like China. China built a deep sea port in Peru, and they basically got a really great one-sided deal. They got the exclusive right of first refusal for the fishing rights around Peru. And when they do these infrastructure projects, they get right of first refusal yep. for the mineral, for the oil, and it really strips the country. Of course.
And we need to let people know about that. That's Allison Nguyen, a refugee from Vietnam here in the United States, an entrepreneur and now very much a Donald Trump supporter. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. Daily question to all the Dems in our government.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Now, the one with the brain, Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. How would you like somebody with schizophrenia to be involved in air traffic control? Well, apparently that is part of the plan of DEI. And thankfully, I think DEI is going to D-I-E in the Trump administration when it finally formally arrives on January the 20th. I thought we'd talk about it with Dr. Henry Miller, who's a medical doctor, molecular biologist. He's the Glenn Swagger Distinguished Fellow at the American Council on Science and Health. Dr. Miller, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Lars.
Thank you. What is this about paranoid schizophrenics as air traffic controllers? Because it sounds like something made up by the Babylon Bee.
It really does. And I wrote about this recently and have before. The FAA's official stance on recruiting says that they're actively seeking workers with, quote, disabilities that the federal government has identified for special emphasis in recruiting and hiring, unquote. What are those targeted disabilities? They include, quote, hearing, vision, missing extremities, partial paralysis, complete paralysis, epilepsy, severe intellectual disability, psychiatric disability, and dwarfism. And I, before we went on the air, I checked that the FAA website still has all of that wording, and it does. And it's incredible. And as I said at the end of my article on this, how would you like a paranoid schizophrenic traffic controller directing your plane the next time you're landing at a major airport?
I mean, it makes no sense. But Dr. Miller, look, I think there may be jobs in society for people with various disabilities. In fact, I remember talking to a guy who made a kind of a complicated device that he sells to police departments called, I forget what it's called, but it's a spike strip that'll stop, you know, cars they're trying to stop, except that it's mounted to the front of the police car. And I said, where do you make these things? He said, you'll love it. We make it at a sheltered workshop with autistic people. And I said, how does that work out? He says, these are people who work in a sheltered workshop, but their autism actually allows them to completely focus on what they're doing. So they do it great, even though the device is kind of complicated and has a lot of moving parts and all that. He said they do a great job, where the disability actually is a benefit to doing the job and allows them to do worthy kinds of tasks. But I don't think does the FAA does not, nor does air traffic control, seem like the kind of place that would lend itself to where your disability actually works for you. Say, vision problems for an air traffic controller. I know most of what they're doing is looking at a screen and sometimes looking out the window and looking at computers. But how in the world do any of these disabilities aid them in doing the job versus perhaps increasing the number of mistakes?
Well, this is a blind, slavish dedication to a bad principle, and that's DEI, diversity, inclusion, equity. It just doesn't work for everything.
Doesn't anybody within that agency, when somebody says we ought to include people with mental, physical disabilities, vision disabilities and the like, severe intellectual disability, psychiatric disability, when they bring up these ideas, doesn't anybody who's been working in air traffic control of the FAA say, boss, that's a crazy idea. It's going to lead to more airplane crashes and dead people?
Well, they should. And in fairness, Lars, they're probably not going to make them air traffic controllers. But what they are going to do is give them desk jobs, secretarial jobs at the agencies. But that's harmful, too. And as you know, we've discussed that. I have experience at FDA with secretaries who couldn't take a phone number from a caller. We had a what's called a consumer safety officer, a guy who just moves the paper along, an easy but still difficult job, requires organization. He was a paranoid schizophrenic, and he would barricade himself in his office sometimes for an entire work shift. And not come out of his office. And the division director tried to fire him, couldn't get it past the labor panel.
HR.
Yeah.
Well, you could, in an agency like FDA, I could see making mistakes in that, which might literally turn out to be deadly. Am I wrong?
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. But equally important, it just slows down the efficiency of the government, such as it is. It inhibits it. One other example from my years at FDA, when I was a division director, the Clinton administration invented a program to take minority students from D.C. high schools and put them in part-time in agencies to, quote-unquote, inculcate a work ethic, unquote. Well, we had a high school girl, who was supposedly an A student, who was unintelligent and unmotivated and took half an hour to deliver a document from one part of the building to another. Then she got pregnant and would spend hours talking to her boyfriend, and I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't discipline her. I couldn't
except
fire
that,
her.
Henry, if you're going to inculcate a work ethic, there has to be a consequence, as in show up for work on time. If you don't, you get docked some pay, and at some point you get a pink slip. That's how you. If somebody arrived at the ripe old age of 18 and couldn't show up on time, the way you get them a work ethic is you say, if you don't show up on time one more time, you're fired. And in the meantime, we're docking you an hour's pay, and there's a consequence. That's how you train anybody, isn't it?
It is. Well, let me tell you the outcome of that. One day, my secretary came in and said, our A student is using prepaid FedEx envelopes to send love notes to her boyfriend.
Oh, my God.
So I picked up the phone, called the administrator, and I said, if our student shows up on Monday, I'm going to feel compelled to call the FBI and tell them that she's stealing government property.
Yeah.
And I never saw her again.
I mean, even back then, Henry, that means those love notes were like $10 a pop to send them off to her boyfriend with overnight delivery?
Oh, absolutely. And you and I paid for that, and I was furious. But, you know, this is how, unfortunately, government programs work. They take on a life of their own, and they're not critically evaluated.
So tell me this, what kind of results do you think that people like Elon Musk and Ramaswamy might have if they say, look, we want to cut the number of federal agencies from, I think it's close to 500 of them, down to maybe less than 100, if they're up against that, but they've got somebody like Trump that's willing to push really, really hard and impound funds and things like that, do you think they're going to have any luck in being able to bust up some of that nonsense?
I think they will have some luck. I think they'll have luck at getting rid of a lot of the DEI kinds of programs and a lot of the excess baggage that these agencies have. I would also hope, though, that privately they have some input now into some of the appointments that the president-elect has been making. And, of course, I have in mind RFK Jr. to head HHS, which he is eminently unqualified to do, and, in fact, disqualified from doing. And Jay Bhattacharya at NIH, again, just unqualified and with a bad record on science and public policy. And there are a few others. So I hope they have input into that as well as draining the swamp that exists.
Is there anybody you could name that you think would be a good bureaucracy buster?
A good what?
Bureaucracy buster.
Mitch Daniels, who is director of OMB, Office of Management and Budget, in a previous administration, and then a longtime president of Purdue University. People like him, Susan Dudley, who was also at OMB, head of the Office of Information Other Affairs.
Well, I want to see him bust up the federal bureaucracy, but good. That's Dr. Henry Miller from the American Council on Science and Health.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
What is dementia? Is it the...
Want to listen to an interview again? Check out LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Of the approximately $8 billion that the international community, including the United States, has dedicated to Afghanistan, about $10 million of that is 0.1%, has no doubt gotten to the Taliban in terms of
I don't care if
fees,
it's that gum penny.
I don't care if it's a penny.
And I love the fact that we've got members of Congress, in this case, Congressman Burchett, who still use the word dad gum. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to give you more of that conversation, especially when Representative Brian Mast weighed into Anthony Blinken, soon to be the former Secretary of State of the United States of America, about the tens of billions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, that have gone to the Taliban in Afghanistan. And if you say, no, we left Afghanistan. We left all that weaponry behind. We left all those assets behind. We left some Americans behind as well. But now we're sending them cash? Yes, we are. And I want to get into some of the reasons they're sending it, like carpet weaving, believe it or not. First, though, let's go to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Jessica is a naysayer who goes first. Jessica, if you listen to this show, you know we love naysayers. So welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. And what do we disagree about?
Hi, Lars, a longtime listener, first time ever naysayer.
Wow.
Yes, don't be mean to me, Lars.
Okay.
I agree
I'll
with you
gentle.
So much of the time. But I really, drug testing people who need welfare, I just don't think that that's an American thing. I understand it for people who you might assume use that system, but what about the person who truly needs it and it is humiliated that they have to need it? Because really, you should be humiliated. I mean,
Hold on. Let me, for a clarification, are you humiliated because they find drugs in your system, or are you humiliated because you took the drug test and you came up clean? Which one is humiliating?
I mean, if I had to use that program and I was already, you know, embarrassed that I have to use that program and I really needed it, I would be humiliated that I have to go and pee in a cup and be tested for drugs.
You are aware that there are a lot of working Americans, men and women, who are routinely drug tested in their jobs, like commercial drivers, CDL licenses. And do you think they should be humiliated that we say we don't want somebody high on methamphetamine behind the wheel of an 18-wheeler?
No, because that involves other people's safety. I just think that's kind of different when it involves other people's safety. I just don't think that it's very Christian of us when we are giving help to people who, you know, ideally actually need the help. There are definitely people who
Let me ask a clarifying question. If you have to have somebody else help you buy your groceries, it may be because you're short of money. Most people, I wasn't born into wealth. You get money by working. If you've got drugs in your system, are you available to go and work most jobs in America?
I mean, I don't think so. I do think people do take advantage of the program. That's no doubt.
I know that, but that's a separate issue. That's a separate issue. Let's just stick with this. So you say, I need help buying groceries. And I say, okay, have you spent any money on drugs this week? And you said, yeah, I like to buy some weed. I got some methamphetamine, a little fentanyl for Friday night to have a party. And I say, if you've got money for drugs, why am I buying your groceries? Can you answer that one?
Right. No, that'd be absurd. Of course.
Okay.
Absurd,
so, so we want to drug test people to keep the people who are, number one, wasting their money on drugs and wasting themselves with drugs. We don't buy their groceries. So it's an incentive to get off the drugs. Number two, if they've got drugs in their system, that means they're not available for most jobs. Most jobs have a requirement that says you can't have drugs in your, even the ones that don't do CDL tests, they say, we don't want drug, we don't want a druggie working in a shop with the bandsaws or, you know, or drill presses or things like that. Bad idea. We don't want a guy who's on fentanyl while he's driving a forklift holding a ton of cargo up above the heads of his coworkers. So we're going to drug test you. And you don't have any choice. At that point, I would think the law-abiding person who's not taking drugs would say, fine, I'll show you that I'm clean. And then they get the benefit. And it's not embarrassing them. It's saying we need to make sure. And that person would appreciate, we don't want to give your grocery money to somebody who's got money to waste on drugs, who's wasted on drugs, who isn't out trying to work and improve himself or herself. And that's why we're doing it. Is that unreasonable to do that?
I mean, I see that argument, but I guess I'm just naive. And I wish that that wasn't something that had to be done. I don't know how prevalent it is that
I already know the answer to this question, but Jessica, do you have any friends who are unrepentant drug users?
Maybe not friends, but I've definitely
known people.
And I have a family member. So,
but at that point, if you give them an incentive to get off the drugs, is that positive for their life?
Oh, definitely.
Okay, yeah. Now hold on. Now let's take the other side of that one. If you say to them, even if you like to get high and you spend a bunch of money on drugs, we're glad to buy your groceries. Have you just incentivized them to stay on the drugs?
Yeah, definitely. I guess I just
do you
like
want to do that, Jessica?
There's not as many people. No, I don't. I just like to think that there's not as many people who are drug addicts that are using that system.
Well, hold on, Jessica. Last year, more than 100,000 people overdosed on fentanyl alone. Okay, so that's not counting the methamphetamine folks, the heroin folks, just fentanyl. Over 100,000 people died from it last year. That means to get that many deaths, you have to have a gigantic number of people who are routinely using what we call hard drugs. Not pot, but we're talking about cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, fentanyl, things like that. So there are a lot of people out there who are affected by drug addiction. And if we say, we're happy to buy your groceries while you're addicted. To me, I've told the story before. My dad was an unrepentant alcoholic. He's long since passed away. I never, as an adult, I never would have bought him booze, period. And even if you said, oh, I could really use a drink, I'm not buying you booze. You're an addict. I won't participate in it. If you're one of those,
right.
And Jessica, do you smoke cigarettes?
No.
Do you have any friends who do?
Well, my stepmom
okay.
says, yeah.
Okay. And if your stepmom said, hey, pick me up a carton of smokes, would you say,
no,
I'd be happy to, huh?
No, but well, is there
no,
a problem
and because
with,
you say, I don't want any part of that, right?
Right.
You can smoke
right.
if you want to. I'm not going to stop you, but I won't be part of it. Well, to me, a system that says we're going to give you free health insurance, Medicaid. We're going to give you free groceries, SNAP. We're going to give you free housing, Section 8. We're going to give you all these other, and TANF, welfare, what they used to call welfare, now they fancied up with the name of TANF. They said, we're going to give you all these free stuff, and we know you're a drug addict. So we know that any cash you manage to get by selling your food stamp benefits, by making other kinds of side deals, by taking your TANF and spending it on methamphetamine or heroin instead of spending it on your kids and your family, we're happy to help you out with that. Jessica, can you tell me morally where we are as a country if we say we're happy to give you the resources so you can keep on taking drugs that will probably eventually take your life in a really horrible way? Where are you morally
right.
if you do that?
I don't agree with that. That's definitely a good point. But do we have a problem with drug addicts taking advantage of these particular systems?
I would get to that, but I'd ask it to you this way. So this person who regularly and routinely is addicted to hard drugs, what do you suppose their day job is?
Well, of course they don't have one, but are they on
okay,
Tuesday?
Hold on. Then where are they living? How are they housing themselves?
Okay.
How are they feeding themselves? And what happens when they OD? Who pays the bill? Well, we're paying for all that. So when you say, gee, I wonder if this person who isn't working and is spending hundreds of dollars on illegal drugs, I wonder where they're getting that money. And sadly, Jessica, they're getting it from us. And if they don't get it through the social welfare programs, they get it by stealing from us. And that's one more harm. But Jessica, you are a great naysayer. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. Miss something on the Lars Larson Show? Check out posted interviews and podcasts at LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment, but I have a real concern. I work in radio. I've worked in radio almost 50 years. Radio takes electricity. So electricity has been near and dear to my heart for a long time. And in Joe Biden's America, the America he leaves behind, thank God, just next month, our energy grid is fragile, is expensive, and it is reliant on foreign adversaries. So I thought we'd talk about it with Jason Isaac, who's CEO and founder of the American Energy Institute. Jason, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, it's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
So tell me this. Do you think, based on the polls, that average Americans are aware of just how fragile our electric grid is?
No, and that's polling that we have recently released that shows that an overwhelming majority don't realize that two-thirds of our nation is at an elevated risk of energy shortfalls. That's electricity, especially as we approach winter when we see the sun not as prevalent during storms, solar panels covered in snow, the wind doesn't blow as strong. It happened in Texas in 2021 with Winter Storm Uri. Hundreds of people lost their lives. But overwhelmingly, people just don't realize they're at an elevated risk because of this overdependence on Chinese-made, unreliable, variable sources of weather-dependent generation, commonly referred to as wind and solar.
I guess I'm tempted to compare this to fish and water. Is the fish aware of all the water around him? No. He's been in water his whole life. He's going to be in water all his whole life, and when he's not around water, he's not going to be alive anymore. That we have that thought. I still remember when they talked about Saddam Hussein's Iraq, where the power was off in most parts of the country for at least some part of every day, except Saddam's hometown of Tikrit, which apparently had power 24 hours a day. And you look at that and think, ah, wow, what a third world country. They can't even keep the lights turned on all the time. That we've had it as such a reality in our lives that you walk to the wall, flip a switch, and things happen. Lights go on, heat comes on, computers go on, and we just take it as a given, like a fish takes water as a given.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That happens every day in South Africa as well. Today, between 3 and 7 o'clock, they'll have load shedding. That's what it's called when they have to do these rolling outages because they don't have enough electricity to meet their demand. But the elected officials in South Africa are taking bribes from Germany not to expand their coal-fired generation. I've testified in front of Congress numerous times, and I've said of all the technology the Chinese steal from us, it would be nice if they would utilize our pollution control technology, because we have here in the United States, and we've become world leaders in clean air. And this is something that our polling also shows, that over 60% of Americans don't realize that we meet the World Health Organization standards for safe and clean air up until a couple of years ago when they made these standards more strict that go beyond anything that improves health. They did that because we were the world's largest economy and we were meeting those standards and producing more oil, gas, coal generation for electricity and products that move our lives. So they didn't like that. So they changed the standards again beyond anything that improves human health.
Well,
but wouldn't it be great if South Africa could do that?
It would be
bribed by Germany.
But why is Germany, when Germany back at home seems to have realized that getting rid of the coal plants and the nuclear plants was a colossally stupid idea and was likely to leave them freezing to death in the dark, but they're still bribing South Africa not to use their own coal?
Yeah, so they can meet their own climate goals of decarbonization, which is really the climate cult Kool-Aid. Decarbonization does nothing to mitigate a changing climate. It's 0.04% of our atmosphere. And what man has contributed is such a tiny fraction of that CO2, but it's what the left is clinging on to. And now you've even got people on the right that are saying, oh, we've got to do all this carbon capture stuff. It does nothing. There's a great video of Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana asking the Department of Energy, if we spend $50 trillion, what does it do? And even you using the UN's models, it does nothing to mitigate a changing climate. It just makes everything more expensive, or as I like to call it, ESG, expensive, scarce, and government controlled. So Germany is just bribing South Africa to live in dark while people in Germany are freezing to death. European freezing deaths are on the rise because of this energy being expensive and scarce.
Well, let me ask you about this, too, because this is one of more of those nuts and bolts. And I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think the United States builds, 680 or so miles of high tension lines. And you say, OK, well, you replace the old ones. You're putting in some new ones. That's great. How many do we need? And the number we need to connect all those windmills and all those solar panels, even if the Greens achieve their ultimate, you know, nirvana, where they've got all the wind and solar they need something like tens of thousands of miles of this stuff. And we're not building it fast enough, nor do we have the capability or even either human or material capability to build the amount of lines that we'll need by 2030 if you want to go down that path. Am I generally right in that picture?
You're absolutely right. And not to mention, it would take 1,000 years to mine the copper necessary to meet those requirements. So I'm not really good at math, but I think 1,000 years is going to be pretty past 2030. But this is absolutely certain. It's because we're so heavily subsidizing this Chinese made unreliable electric generation, wind and solar, and we're putting it out in the middle of nowhere when we should be building electric generation closer to demand. You don't put a grocery store out in the middle of nowhere. You don't put restaurants out in the middle of nowhere. You put them where people are, and that's what we should be doing, and we can do that. And we do. There's coal-fired power plants in big metropolitan areas all around this country, natural gas, nuclear. That's the safest, most dense form of electric generation, and because of our pollution control technology, we're world leaders in clean air, and we're number one when it comes to access to clean and safe drinking water.
Well, and Jason, one of the things that got me angry, because ordinarily I like technology, and I realize that most of the tech, you know, the big deal tech people, Gates and that whole bunch, that they're in a business, they make stuff. And then they said, oh, gee, we're the ones who've been pushing the rest of the country. They're largely liberals. They push the green agenda. And they said, oh, but for our power, we don't want to depend on wind and solar. We're going to build or buy some nuclear power plants. And I thought, you know, when the rich guys, the guys whose whole business depends on electricity, say, we're not going to build wind and solar, we want nuclear, you'd think that'd be a signal to the rest of us, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would, absolutely. Microsoft has exemptions from the California Air Resources Board to have dozens of diesel generators parked on site because they can't count on the grid in California. So they get exemption from the air quality permits to put these generators on site so that they can keep their data centers powered. They're starting to wake up to this realization that they need coal, they need natural gas, and they need nuclear. And coal and natural gas are the cheapest, most abundant forms that we produce more responsibly than anywhere on the planet.
And we have lots and lots of it. That's Jason Isaac. Jason, thanks very much. He's the CEO and founder of the American Energy Institute. And boy, I'd love to have a smart naysayer who actually thinks, oh, no, wind and solar, that's the future. And then explain to me how the math pencils out. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
You know a veteran in need?